Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
I just know that there's periods of the year where I'm really good at one thing and one part of that, and the other things are sort of, I'm maybe not as good at them. And I've just learned that those cycles just have to be, that's just what they are. And it's like, I guess the only thing I've really gotten comfortable with is knowing that it all happens in cycles, and that, and it just like depression, like if you deal with depression, this is a thing you learn, it will end. Eventually. And so knowing that there is going to be a time where there's a shift, like I probably don't see any of my friends during the summer because of the summer arts camp I run. I barely see anybody. And all I really can focus on is like my day job and running the summer arts camp. I barely get in the studio. Aria goes to camp with me. So I get to see her. So I do fine parenting. And then I run this camp and I have nothing else to give. And, you know, and my friends have to be okay with that. And, you know, my studio has to be okay with that. I build my studio around that now. You know, there's all that stuff.
I am so excited to welcome Jessica Caldas to the Artist Mother Podcast today. Jessica is a Puerto Rican American, Georgia and Florida-based artist. Her work connects personal and community narratives, usually centered on the experiences of women and women-identifying folks, to larger themes and social issues through bodily, multidisciplinary works. Caldas received her MFA at Georgia State University and received her BFA in printmaking from the University of Georgia. She's part of Living Melody Collective, a multidisciplinary collective of femme artists that is based in Atlanta, but she's also nomadic along the East Coast and throughout the Southeast. She currently runs Good News Arts, a small community art space and gallery in rural North Central Florida. Jessica, welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast. We have so much to talk about.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
I'm so happy to have you. So let's kind of just jump right in. We were already chatting a bit before the call, and there's lots of things I want to get to, but I think it's important to go back and frame how you got to where you are now. So I like to always start by asking if art was a part of your childhood. Was being an artist something that you kind of always had as a point of reference or a goal that you were working towards? Or how did this, you know, career find you?
For me, yes. I always say I'm really privileged because art has been a part of my life and my family for as long as I can remember. And in a lot of different ways, which I think kind of specifically helps how I understand art in the world as an adult. My grandfather was an artist. He painted, he took photos, he drew all the time. And he only did it as sort of like a thing in his private life. It was not what he did professionally. He didn't show his work anywhere. But his walls, the walls of my aunts, the walls of my father are covered in paintings, mm-hmm. or were covered in paintings that he had done. And so I always just kind of knew it as like a complete whole part of his life, even if it wasn't something he was like putting out into the world publicly. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, my mother, when I was little, got a job at the Atlanta Arts Festival, or the Arts Festival of Atlanta. There's a new Atlanta Arts Festival, but back in the 90s, the Arts Festival of Atlanta was one of the country's biggest arts festivals, and definitely the biggest in the Southeast. And it happened in Piedmont Park, which is this park central to the city of Atlanta. And it was a huge deal. It was just this week-long art-centric festival. It had, you know, booths of artists and makers selling their work. They incorporated public art components. They had galleries that would connect to the shows. And for me and my sister, I have a twin, and we were we were a part of this world for like,
yeah.
My mom did accounting for them. She wasn't, okay. She would not have considered herself an artist or a creative person, even though she was. But she collected art from this festival every year. So our house was always full of work. And every year we'd get to play hooky for like 2 to 3 days and just hang out at the festival. And even though we were very little, I think, I'm not sure if like today, if modern, in the modern days, like this is something my mom would do. She let us just run wild.
Just roam. I mean, oh yeah.
And we would just roam together. And we'd talk to artists and we'd talk, they were always like performers too. We'd talk to performers, we'd run around. And it just was like a part of my life. And that's kind of how it's always been. Like for my whole family, art has just been a fact of life. And when I decided, I think in first grade, that I wanted to be an artist, which is very much thanks to a teacher that year, it was never like, think about something else. It was always like, oh yeah, that's totally possible. That is a total reality that you can live. And there was no question about it.
Oh, that's so amazing. First, that you had that connection to your grandparent who was an artist and, you know, was collecting work and sharing, putting his own work on the walls, that your mom was like active in, although from kind of a tertiary position, like she was part of the Atlanta art scene and was mm-hmm. connecting with artists and like supporting them, like financially putting their art on your walls. Like, so cool. I think that just like, it's not that your parents had to take you to a museum or had to do XYZ, but even having parents who purchased and hung original art on, you know, in their home. Like I just like did not grow up with anybody who had original art in their homes, which is just kind of crazy when you think about it. I'm like,
yeah. As yeah. an adult, I realized how I don't think growing up I knew, like I just didn't know, you know, I didn't mm-hmm. even really pay attention. But as an adult, I've definitely realized how many people don't do that.
And I know.
Like, I go into other, you know, other parents' homes or friends' homes and they don't always have a lot of art on their walls or things. And I'm like, mm-hmm. wait, what is happening? Why?
I know.
Like this. And it's surprising to me. But I realize every, like, there's always like every year I feel like I just realize how much, I mean, it was really a privilege, you know, not only that my family was supportive, but that they surrounded us with art just kind of naturally. There was no yeah. question. And, you know, you're talking about being a part of the Atlanta art scene. My mom's best friends worked in the arts festival too. Many of them are artists who still practice in the Atlanta art scene today.
Amazing.
Who I'm still connected to as peers in the Atlanta arts community. It's wild.
Wow. That's so cool. And so cool for them to have like known you as this kid running around the festival. And then you, you became an artist. I do have to say your comment about being a kid and running around the festival and like, you wouldn't do that today. It reminded me, my dad had a friend who sold waffles at carnivals and like state fairs. And sometimes we would go, he would work with Kevin in the waffle stand and me and my cousin would run amok in the carnival. And like, never in a million years would I let my kids do that. Now it's like so funny.
I mean, I wonder, like, would I let my daughter do that?
I know.
I mean, one year I even crashed a golf cart because they drove around the park in golf carts. And I don't remember who gave us the key, but yeah. my sister and I were like riding one around. I think we were like 9.
Yes.
And like, crashed into a telephone pole and like knocked the telephone pole over.
Oh my gosh. I can just picture like all these, you know, the tents of artists, like the little kid knocks them down and they all crumble.
It's like out of a book or something, but it happened. And I'm like, why was I driving a golf cart?
Yes.
But it was great.
Okay. Well, Jessica, your work that you make is incredibly powerful. It takes up space. It's so rich and dynamic. You have like a quite a range of work that you make. I want you to talk a little bit about your practice and kind of, you know, what's your elevator pitch for your work? What do you say that your work is about? And what are some of the kind of the ways that you think about yourself materially as an artist? Like, what are you drawn to and what do you make?
So I always describe myself as a multidisciplinary artist because, like you said, I feel like the breadth of my work is pretty broad. I'm trained as a printmaker. I paint, I draw. I've been doing that my whole life. But right now, the work I'm most focused on are these large-scale soft sculptures that are sort of abstract figurative sculptures. I call them tired bodies. Mm-hmm. And they incorporate elements of installation and sculpture that sort of in spaces that they inhabit and which I invite audiences to inhabit with them. And the tired bodies sort of take on meaning that are often connected to stories that I've collected from others or personal stories or from literature or research that are then sort of like illustrated through these narratives, through the objects that are around the tired bodies, or even through the ways that I embellish or put together the tired bodies or the materials I use for them. Mm-hmm. So these installations, you know, they range in scale. A lot of them are sort of life size, like the size of a human figure or larger. Some are way larger and monumental in scale. And then sometimes, and I've been experimenting more with this, is like a smaller scale sort of moment to interact with these figures and with these objects. A lot of the work right now is dealing with themes of care and labor, especially as it ties to issues of identity and gendered, especially gendered identities. And in particular, in the next year or two, and for the past year, I've really been exploring motherhood, mm-hmm. Which I'm going to like add a caveat of like, when I say motherhood, like that's my own positionality where I'm like, I'm a mother, so I'm going to often refer to it that way. But I'm really talking about parenthood and mm-hmm. building, even in sort of a broader sense of like, not just like we labor and birth these bodies out of ourselves, but we also build families and we build connections to each other where we're caring for each other outside of that direct heteronormative like birthing. So,
yes, I love that term, family building. I haven't really heard that before, actually. And I'm, you know, like I've been doing this work under sort of the artist mother label for many years now, and am slowly kind of, I wouldn't say unraveling that, but like the way I framed it is like making the circle wider of just experimenting with using the term caregiver more, right? Mm-hmm. Because care, like the practices of care are not solely within the motherhood identity. And just like, you know, I think part of like my work has been providing visibility and helping to establish and support a foundation for artist mothers to be visible. But then it's like, we got to move outward beyond that too. So I look forward to like chewing on that term family building and kind of adding that to my canon of, you know, language and things to think about in this context. So thank you.
I love that. Yeah. And I really do. I like this, I feel like I've seen too, like a broadening of like parent artist resources and mother artist resources, like broadening mm-hmm. into caregiver as a general, mm-hmm. more general approach. And I think it's so appropriate because there really are so many ways that we're asked to care for each other in our lives, and like so many people performing that labor in so many different capacities. And I think it's mm-hmm. really important to acknowledge all of that. And I'm just really intrigued by it too. So I still chew on it a lot myself. So
yes. Well, and I'll just share like a tangible way that it has come up recently is we opened our call for Painting at Night, which is kind of our like big artist mother exhibition. We started in 2020, we did a 2021 iteration and 2022, and then have since moved it to an every other year show mm-hmm. because the community has like grown so much. But this year is the first year that we said like, no, the artist mother identity is not inclusive enough. And that's like, I think this conversation can be very triggering for people when you don't feel safe and secure in your motherhood identity. Mm-hmm. You then, when someone says like a show just for artist mothers is not enough, like please hear the softness in my framing of that, because the artist mother identity is at the center of that. And what I am asking now for my community to do is like expand beyond that. Who you have felt the burden of being marginalized. We wouldn't want to marginalize others in our like intentionality of creating safety for our own identity. And so this year, the 2024 iteration of Painting at Night is open to artists who identify as caregivers for the first time. And of course the show will be primarily artist mothers, I think. But I'm really excited to see how even just that small change in this like open call, you know, diversifies the conversation and provides visibility to even more folks who are part of this conversation, you know, and who even just that slight change of language are really affected by that. So
yeah, I think it's great. I saw that actually. I saw the call and I was like, oh, they've changed the language. It's good.
Yeah,
I think you know, there's what you're talking about, this like this reaction sort of to broadening language to be more inclusive can sometimes be really negative. And I think it comes from this like really earnest place of fear where mm-hmm. people are just like, they're scared, right? Or they've had bad experiences in the past, or they're worried that they might somehow lose. And and we all experience that, right? Mm-hmm. That's a very human reaction and fear to have. And so every time if I ever feel that, I'm always just like, I like try to sit with it and say, what am I actually losing anything? Is there anything that's actually happening to me that isn't good, or that is, that's,
yes.
It's just like what, and sitting with that and then reminding myself that it is never bad to include and to like give and hold space for others in our spaces. So,
well, okay. To tie this all back to art hanging on your wall.
Yes.
I have this print that I purchased as like a fundraiser that the artist Sarah Boitz-Yoder was somehow connected to. This was like years ago. We've had this print like hanging in our dining room for, I don't know, probably 4 or 5 years. But what the print says, it's like this image of like hands or something. But the print says, more for you is not less for me. Mm-hmm. And like, I just love that idea of, you know, and of course, like I've chosen to have this art in my dining room because I think about that a lot in relationship to like food scarcity and just mm-hmm. like the tangible ways that resources become these like things that people have to hold on to, right? But just because somebody else is getting, you know, an experience of more inclusivity, like the circle is widening, you're still in the circle, right? Yeah. Like, and
you're still in it. You still get stuff too.
Yeah. It's yeah. Just
like more people get to have the thing too.
Yeah. So full circle moment here. Mm-hmm. We're 10 minutes in and we can just shut it off right now. Okay. Yes. So Jessica, you talked about how in your practice recently, you've kind of been pulling threads from like specific narratives or stories, I think you said. I was wondering if you could give us an example, because you kind of talked about that more broadly. And I'm like, ooh, what specifically are you talking about? Like Greek goddesses or like Winnie the Pooh or like what are kind of these?
So there's kind of like a couple of ways that it happens. And so like the easiest thing to talk about is my most recent show, which was at Mocha, Georgia. And in fact, I did and pull from like Greek mythology and goddesses for the titles mm-hmm. and the literature for sort of the inspiration for how I presented these figures to the public. So they all ended up with names. And my naming conventions for tired bodies are always sort of consistent. There's like sort of this longer phrase that might come from like an idea or a text, like it's an actual like quote from a text or just a line or something that has to do with something broader. And then in parentheses, it's always an actual name. Mm. And so for all of these pieces, it was generally a quote that I had pulled from either a work of fiction or literature or like one of the classical texts relating to these women in Greek mythology, and then like that person's name. So for example, one of my favorites is the tired body I called Helen. Mm-hmm. And the longer text was a name can be in many places at once. Mm. And I just, those conventions are very like, and those are drawn, obviously they're very generalized, but for me, each of the figures in that show were really drawing on pretty personal stories around mothering and care in mm-hmm. my life. You know, one of the pieces dealt with sort of actually, fairly directly with miscarriage. And that was drawn from a family member who like shared her story with me. And then another was drawn from my experiences with abortion and choice, mm-hmm. things like that. And then the others are more general sort of facets around identity and like my struggle sort of with both being a mother and a woman and how mm-hmm. I feel like so often we're asked to be like one thing as a mother mm-hmm. when we're really like all the things, like, you know, mm-hmm. we can be a sexual being and we can have a baby and we can, you know, work and we can do all these things. And then additionally, this sort of complicated idea where I feel like in an ideal world, family building and in all the senses, not just in the actual physical birthing, but like in all the senses can be sort of a model for community building, especially mm-hmm. in the complicated ways power dynamics happen and give and take happen in community and in families and things like that. But to get more specific, there's this older piece that I, this older tired body I did, which is drawn directly from my mother's experiences as a caregiver throughout her life. It's called The Caregiver, parentheses Elizabeth, which is her name. And essentially I've always talked to her a lot about this, but I talked to her specifically about this sort of position she found herself in because of the nature of her childhood and then her early adulthood and then her now status as a grandmother, which is as a child, she was very much the caretaker for her family because her parents were dealing with things. There was a lot of trauma in her childhood. And so she was often taking care of her brothers and in ways taking care of her parents and just sort of forced to take on this role of caretaker as a child and for much of her adolescence. And then she had kids so young that, you know, she went immediately into this new role of caretaking of her own children and spent her life doing that. And then it's funny because she, you know, those were like forced roles and she always felt like she missed out on some things through those roles. And that she may not have made those choices for herself given other options or other paths to take, but she did. And then once I had my daughter, she kind of immediately made this choice to come and move and be with us to help care for her. But it was a very active choice. Right. And so she says this role now as a caretaker is one she's so invested in and one that she so feels so much better about. And so this piece is sort of about this cycle of caretaking that some especially women identifying folks find themselves in, whether they want to be or not. And so I was very interested in that story. Now for the next couple of years, I'm doing all the story collecting. So who knows where it's going to go, but I'll actually be doing like interviews and group story shares about birthing and unbirthing and things like that. And that'll all feed into new sculptures. So,
okay. So you like perfectly set up this piece about your mom. Tell me how that translated into materiality. Like what, you know, you kind of talked about the things that were important about your story to her, like this idea of choice and this idea of these like cycles. Mm-hmm. How did you decide what the piece was going to look like? You know, what avenues to take with that, especially as a multidisciplinary artist, like there's lots of options, right?
Yeah. Well, the tired bodies are always these kind of soft, weird looking things to me, right? And that's important because they have this innate intimacy mm-hmm. to them, which because of they're made from like used house linens and bed sheets and things like that. So there's softness and there's intimacy and it's kind of gross also. And they mm-hmm. look kind of weird because their limbs are really long and exaggerated, which also looks like intestines. Mm-hmm. There's this, and then there's this hyper saturated color tone that I use, which is all these pinks and purples and reds. And so that is both like cueing the internal body, but also some romanticism, but also some grossness. So mm-hmm. there's like a lot of that that kind of gets tangled up into each other with the materials. And for that piece, I remember it's one of the only Tired Bodies that doesn't have sort of this solid column of like of torso. Mm. It's actually a round torso, like it's okay. like a circle. And I don't remember what, when I drew it out, I don't remember why it was like, the obvious thing is like, I'm thinking about cycles and circles of life and all of that sort of obvious, like, like symbolism. But what was really important to me is I have this old antique family rocking chair and I wanted the figure to be inseparable from the chair, from the rocking chair, which of course is this great symbol of like, you know, you rock your baby, you care, et cetera, right? Or you get old and you sit in a rocking chair on your front porch as you age, like all of these ways that we care for our bodies, even in a chair, right? And so the circle of the torso goes through the bottom of the chair and it's like, it is a part of the, like, it can't be separated from the chair. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in the chair is like a cinder block. And I don't use the blocks or bricks as much as I used to, but they were a big part of the original sort of series of Tired Bodies that I did, because I think a lot, and I probably will return to some of that imagery, but, you know, so much of these like things we talk about, our emotions and how they affect us, are like really affecting us physically too. Mm-hmm. Like it's a very physical response that we have to a lot of these ideas and a lot of these things that are happening to us. And so I was like, okay, you know, even if my mom,
the body keeps the score. Have you read that book?
Yeah. I've read parts of it. Yeah.
I have it and I've skimmed it, but I haven't fully read it.
I don't feel like it's necessarily something you're supposed to sit and read from cover to
cover. Yeah. It's not like a toilet reading or, you know.
Right. So, yeah. So it's like, you know, here's the weight of both the lack of choice and the choices that we make. Like, cause even if my mom expresses a lot of joy in her role as a grandmother, she has made a choice that really has shifted the direction of her life as a retired adult, you know? And so it's interesting in that way. And so that weight is represented through that cinder block, which sits in the chair and kind of holds it all down.
Amazing. So, yeah. Tell me a bit about your transition from printmaking, kind of 2D material to 3D. Of course, many, many artists who find themselves in these intense caregiver roles transition to textile-based work sort of because of that. And, mm-hmm. I think that narrative is like very familiar, but so curious if that was part of your transition, but also the scale of these are like giant. So I'm like, I'm not sure if that does translate. How do you make like a giant stuffy when, you know, like, I don't know.
So I feel like the transition actually started for me before I had my daughter. Okay. And I had done actually a big soft sculpture piece a few years prior, like in 2014. And I had my daughter in 2017. But I hadn't returned to it yet. And so I think it actually, for me, there's like this transition from painting, drawing, and printmaking primarily to performance work first. Mm. And that had a lot to do with the stories I was telling and feeling like, as much as I love painting and drawing and printmaking, and I still do that a lot in my practice in small ways and in different ways, I like was really trying to talk about people's stories in ways that felt like they needed more, something more. Like I was mm-hmm. feeling like I wanted to not just like show people things. I wanted them to experience things. Cause a lot of the stories, especially back then, I was dealing primarily with gender-based violence as my subject matter. You know, so much of what people know about these topics is circumstantial and often misinformed. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, it was like, well, if you could experience this more directly, would it change how you understand it? Would it change your empathy and what you know about this experience for the person who's having it, and what we need to change about their experience with the world outside of it? Mm-hmm. That makes sense. So yes. I was doing performances and then I started grad school and I got a studio. And so I was still doing performances, but I was also getting way back into these big paintings and drawings. And then I had my daughter. Mm. That's when I started making the tired bodies, but it was like kind of these jokey little drawings and just these like not as elaborate soft sculptures. I was like, just like I drew the drawings and I was like, I need these to be bigger and I need them to be soft. And one thing I had recalled from that installation I did in 2014, so they were these big six-foot letters. It was actually a text-based piece and they were soft and people could climb in them and like loved that interaction, but they were also really heavy. And they were also, so it's like, if you picked one up, it was like 30 pounds, you know? And so even though it was soft, there was like, and there were like 13 of these letters, if you put them all on top of you, it would feel threatening. Mm. And I loved the nature, like the layered nature of that, where it's like, yes, there's this moment of softness and welcoming and loveliness, but there's also like a threat, or there's also this other thing happening. Even through that material. And mm-hmm. so that's the way I returned to it for the tired bodies. So
amazing.
Yeah. And then it's just been like, I mean, at the time I'm just like sewing, right? I'm just sewing.
Yeah.
Now I'm doing like crochet on them and embroidery, and I'm like learning the quilt, and there's mm-hmm. all the embellishments, and I'm just like trying to elaborate them more and more and more. And I'm really leaning into this, you know, this craft-based women's work, fiber arts history.
Yes.
Because it feels important to like how you build out like these femme coded figures that are like, you know, wildly space taking.
Yes. This episode is sponsored by the Thrive Together Network. TTN is a virtual community I run for women artists. We have a space right on the network for artist caregivers to connect, and it is truly my favorite place on the internet. Every Tuesday, I co-host a session called Art and Tea, where our community comes together to connect as artists. We share our goals and provide accountability for each other and talk about lots of topics artists deal with, ranging from how to put on an exhibition, organization tips for your studio, ways to manage stress, and so much more. The Thrive Together Network is an inclusive platform for artists, and so much is included in your membership. It's crazy. We offer 2 virtual art residencies a year to help you stay on track with your studio goals. We have an exhibition program called Taking Up Space, those Tuesday art and tea sessions that I mentioned. We have monthly workshops on art business, art writing. We even have a book club. Plus, there's hundreds of artists to connect with from all over the world. Because of the Artist Mother partnership with TTN, we have a discount code for you, just for artist caregivers to join the network. You can take $10 off your monthly membership fee for the Thrive Together Network, but your best deal is actually if you sign up for a year with us, commit to a whole year of joining us and joining our programming, and you'll save over $140 on your membership. So head to www.artistmotherpodcast.com/network to learn more and check it out. Membership comes with a free 2-week trial too, so you can truly get in there and see what you think before you actually commit to becoming a member. Just a reminder, on the network, we have a special group for artist caregivers where we have intentional conversations about our roles and identity as artists who are making work and balancing all of the caregiving that we do. We even have quarterly meetups for this group for deeper times of connections. I would really love to get to know you on the network, see more about your work and your art practice, and just connect with you in this amazing, compassionate, intentional, and encouraging community of female artists. We are all about providing resources to help you grow your art career, and this effort is combined with tools and the means to connect with the artists who are on a similar path, who are doing similar things with their careers. So once again, you can head to artistmotherpodcast.com/network to learn more, to get our discount code, and to join the Thrive Together Network. You mentioned something about, you know, kind of having like this career, and you had your daughter, and then the work did change a little bit. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking a lot about how, there was a recent New York Times article about mothers taking a break from their art careers when they have their kids. And there seems to be kind of this spectrum of, you know, artist parents and specifically artist mothers who go through the kind of this identity of becoming a mother. It's like either your creativity feels ignited and you have like a ton of momentum, and there's just like the transformation kind of lights a fire under you, right? Or the transformation in the identity is so overwhelming that like you have to completely disengage. And this is like a spectrum of, you know, kind of the way that I've just like doing this work for years and seeing people react. It's like, and there's this like normalization that I want to happen for all sides of that spectrum. Like, yes, take a break, but also why are we in a system where we have to take a break, but also like make all the work you want to make, like your baby's going to be fine, but also love your baby. Like it's so precious. The time slips away. Like there are all these like ways that we can feel about this that are so mm-hmm. intense. And I guess my question is like, what has been your experience? Like kind of, did you have to take a hard break? Was the fire just lit? Like, was it a little bit of both?
I think it was a lot of things. I was in grad school when I had my daughter. I was in a 3-year program and I had her in the second year.
I did that too.
Yeah. And I kind of didn't have this option. I mean, I guess I could have. Could have been like, I'm going to take a break. But I was, and I actually like, I don't regret it, but it's just like, it's part of like the reality of the decision I made at the time. Because I think I didn't take a break. I was very resistant. I like didn't even take less classes that semester mm-hmm. after, because I had her during the winter break. So I was pregnant right up until finals. And then I had her right after finals. And then I like had 4 weeks off and that's it. And then mm-hmm. I went back to school and back to my day job. And I like, I was just determined. And I think some of that determination, that resistance to like taking a moment to breathe through it and have my baby and like recover emotionally, because I was very fortunate. Again, another great privilege of mine is how easy my labor and delivery was. Oh, yeah. Physically, I was fine, but emotionally, I was like not okay. mm-hmm. But I didn't want to stop. And I think that resistance is partially like that sort of like that fear that I would become irrelevant, or mm-hmm. that people would not take me seriously, or that if I stopped, I wasn't a real artist. Mm-hmm. Like these things that these outside forces and fears that aren't real. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're real because they do happen, and it's a real fear, but like it would have all been fine if I had been like, I'm going to take a semester off. It would have mm-hmm. been fine. But it didn't feel like that to me at the time. And I was really coming to terms with, I had for a long time been like, I'm never going to have kids. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, I got pregnant. I'm like, I'm going to have this kid. It's going to be great. I have a great partner. It's going to be great. And so I just like, I wasn't maybe prepared emotionally in the way some people who like really want to have kids like their whole lives, or who are comfortable with that idea, maybe are. But I was very determined not to stop. And so I kept, not only did I like barely take time off from, I didn't take time off from school. I barely took time off from work because we couldn't afford it. I kept showing and like doing shows outside of school. And I continued to try to do, I was engaged in a lot of like legislative work as a civilian, like so doing like legislative and like lobbying and community grassroots work like that. I tried not to stop doing that. Mm. It was ridiculous. It was really, frankly, it was really silly.
Yeah.
Because it was impossible. And that was when I started to feel like I was failing, like almost immediately. And I couldn't tell you, I like barely remember that first year, which is kind of sad, but also I think very normal for a
first year. I think even if you take
time
like,
off,
don't hold that over your head, because I feel like even if you completely had nothing to do 24/7 for that first year, you're probably not going to remember much of it. Like, you know.
But yeah. So, you know, but it inevitably, I also think all of that is what made me start making tired bodies. Cause I was like,
no kidding.
I was like, I'm so exhausted and I'm failing. And here's a drawing of what that looks like and feels like to me. And here's a tired body. And that's like when I started making them. So, okay.
So good. Thank you for like sharing honestly about your experience. There's like so much I could say, but I just want to ask you if there was a moment or maybe like a series of moments where you realized that you had to make some changes to like the sustainability aspect of, you know, cause you can't go 100% all the time with so many things that you're trying to do. And like, that's like a big lesson that I've really had to learn is like, there's multiple businesses that I run. There's like many things I'm interested in, passionate about, but I can't do all of them all out all the time. Like it's not sustainable. And so I'm just like curious, like what are some of the ways that you've made that rhythm or maybe made it into a rhythm where it became more sustainable? How old is your daughter now?
She's 5 now. She's about to turn 6 on Monday.
So like in the past 6 years, you started really strong. And then, you know, what has kind of shifted? What are some ways that you've made some positive changes for yourself?
Well, one, I have to say, and I hope that this is true for a lot of people, because otherwise I'm going to feel really silly about it, but I think I have to relearn that lesson every year.
Oh, absolutely. I learn it every week. Like I come up with a rule. Like I'm like, we need 2 weekends where we don't have anything booked a month. Right. And then like something comes up and I'm like tempted to break the rule or I'm like, stop making rules for yourself, Caitlin, just live your life.
Like, don't make rules.
Yes. But then I'm like, but the rules are what help me stay sane. Like, exactly.
It's like, but so that constant like negotiating, well, and this is a hard one to answer because I feel like I'm constantly like learning and relearning this lesson and have been for years, for 6 years.
Yeah.
I will say like you sort of asked for like an initial thing. And so like 8 weeks postpartum, I did a performance art piece that was very in line with how I used to perform. And I remember afterwards, I was like, I'm never doing a performance like this again. And I used to do these very long, durational, like very laborious and very hard on my body performances, like very physical, often with like carrying bricks and ropes and tying things. And it just was like, and I just used to like literally beat myself up through these performances. And after I had my daughter, like 8 weeks later, I was like, I did a performance and I was like, I don't enjoy this anymore. This is terrible. This is not how I can treat my body. My body is too special for this. So I stopped performing for a long time. And so that was like the first indicator that there was going to be a significant change to how I approach my work. And I remember at first being kind of scared by it, because for all those same reasons, like, oh, I'm not going to be taken seriously, or my work's changing because I'm a mom and people are going to like know, and they're going to be like think differently about me. And I was like, that's, but over time I was like, okay. I don't know. It's like, this is a hard one to answer. I just feel like it's like, because the problem is I still like to do all the things. So I'm very tempted to still be like, yes. And in 2020, you know, pandemic year, everybody got forced to like slow down in a lot of ways. Like you couldn't do the things because nobody was doing anything, you know? Although I think it was really interesting how creative people got with like finding work for themselves during the pandemic. And for a while I like really embraced that, you know, I had like my day job, which was telecommuting. I was in my studio. I had gotten this year-long residency at the Atlanta Beltline, which I was probably mostly doing remotely because of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And so it was like a very easygoing year for me in a lot of ways, which again, and yet another privilege in my life, because that's not true for everybody. Although my husband was dealing with his own thing where he was like, he was leaving the food industry that year because it was a wreck. So we were dealing with that. But that fall, I was like, I'm going crazy. I'm like losing my mind. Mm-hmm. I'm like, there's not enough for me to feel whole through just doing this. Like just being the stay-at-home mom with a part-time day job that I'm doing from home. Like this isn't enough for me to feel full. Mm-hmm. And I love my daughter and I love being with her. And I love that for 5 years, you know, she was at home with us because we have flexible schedules and we could make that work. Right. And we have help from my mom and, you know, but at the same time, it's not enough for me to just have that.
Yeah.
And the art wasn't enough because it was very like, I had this one project, which is great, but in my mind, I was like, I need more. So that's when I started Good News Arts, which is the gallery and community art space I run in Florida. And I started it. And I was like, here's a project. Let me do this. And
yeah,
immediately like took on all this stuff with that. And it took me a long time to develop a rhythm with that and my day job and mothering and having an art career of my own. And part of that,
we have a lot in common, Jessica. I'm just now realizing this.
so then it's like, okay. And then also like trying to have family and friends and like relationships and, you know, so, I don't know. I don't have a good answer. I just know that there's periods of the year where I'm really good at one thing, at one part of that. And the other things are sort of, I'm maybe not as good at them. And I've just learned that those cycles just have to be, that's just what they are. And it's like, I guess the only thing I've really gotten comfortable with is knowing that it all happens in cycles and that, and it just like depression, like if you deal with depression, this is a thing you learn, it will end eventually. And so knowing that there is going to be a time where there's a shift, like I probably don't see any of my friends during the summer because of the summer arts camp I run. I barely see anybody. And all I really can focus on is like my day job and running the summer arts camp. I barely get in the studio. Aria goes to camp with me. So I get to see her. So I do fine parenting and then I run this camp and I have nothing else to give. And, you know, and my friends have to be okay with that. And, you know, my studio has to be okay with that. I build my studio around that now, you know, there's all that stuff. And so it's just kind of like figuring that out. I don't know. This is not a clear answer. I apologize.
No, well, there's no answer to that question. You know, it's just a process, you know, I've been thinking about this too, because it's kind of like the end of the year, like the start of the new year. What do I want to change? Like, and I struggle. I think I really struggle with the same things you do, in that the only thing I want to change is to have more time to do it all.
Yes.
You know, like, and because like I just feel so passionate about like the many things that I juggle that I hate to like just completely drop off one of them. You know, it's like cutting off a limb. Like it feels so like precious. But then also I think like I've really been trying to identify like that not everything I'm passionate about has to be the work that I do, you know? Like it doesn't have to be my legacy or like part of what I've built. I can just like love on a thing and support a thing and like watch somebody else do it.
Yep.
And I, you know, like, I think there's like this language kind of around like, what is the work that only you can do? You know, like that's like a Elizabeth Gilbert, like Big Magic you know, like what are the jewels that only you can bring forth? And I don't know, that's like something I've been thinking about a lot. Cause I think, like, I just think like you, like I have this like mindset of like, I think it's a little bit scarcity. Like if I don't do it, nobody's going to do it. And right. this is like a need that needs to happen. And like, mm-hmm. I don't know, just like trusting that.
And another, I love this reframing of it and that yeah. and trying to make sure it's not a scarcity. The other thing, and this is actually very important. This is something that I have made a crucial part of my life, the past couple of years, especially, is like, it's not an emergency.
Yes. Nothing yes.
It's an emergency. I am not a doctor in a surgery. Yeah. Trying to save someone's life. which is not to say, like, I don't want, when I say that, sometimes I think people look at me like they're like, so you don't actually care about what you're doing. And I'm like, that is not what no. I said.
Yeah.
No, but if I didn't do it, it wouldn't necessarily like hurt anyone. And it's yes. not really important in terms of life or death,
but it might hurt you.
Right.
If you do it, if you continue to do it too much, you know?
Right. Exactly. And so like knowing that it's not an emergency means like, and this is taking my time. That's really the answer is yes. taking my time. Because yes. I can do all of these things, but only if I take my time doing them and know that if it like I, you know, I send out a newsletter once a week for Good News Arts, right? Mm-hmm. The organization I run, right? If it happens on Thursday instead of Wednesday, it is not the end of the world. And if for some reason it doesn't go out this week, no one's going to be hurt by that.
No one's spleen is exploding all over. Yes.
And like, you know, and I take my time in the studio with my work so much more than I used to. Yeah. I used to like hustle and like, I feel like I have to make and produce. And that's such a false mindset. And it doesn't help the work. Yeah. Like, I feel like it takes me like a year to build like a solid body of work now, partly mm-hmm. because of the materials I'm using, but also because I like to spend 6 months just reading and researching stuff to build yeah. into the work. It's okay. If I don't have 6 to 12 shows a year, that's probably a good thing.
Yeah.
I just, yes. you know, and it's like, there's very little, like, you know, there's external deadlines that you have to meet sometimes, you know, and that's fine. But even like, so I keep a spreadsheet of all the art calls, like deadlines, mm-hmm. right? Like the open calls or proposals I'm going to submit or the grants I'm going to apply for. And I keep them. But I also like, and it's color coded because I'm a geek and it's great. And it's how I organize my brain. I'll share it with you later so you can see.
Yeah.
But I have a color code that for like a missed deadline or deadline I just decided not to submit to. And I, you know, it's red right now. And I've actually been thinking of changing the color because yeah. it's okay to just miss the yes. deadline or to
How
say
about like a lavender.
Yeah. Something
like I chose not, this one is floating off into the ether.
Yeah. And it's okay. Cause it's, guess what? Most of those opportunities are going to come around again. And chances yes. are if I didn't get to it, there's a reason. And
yeah.
Which is, again, I'm not trying to be flippant about stuff.
No,
like,
no.
It's just like, you know, it's just, it's like taking my time with things. And, yes. and I do it a lot with communication too. It's sort mm-hmm. of similar. Like, you know, I've been really trying to train everybody who has access to me that like mm-hmm. they do not have access to me 24/7. Mm-hmm. I don't often text people back after 6 p.m. or 9 a.m. And I often don't text back on the weekends. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of, for a lot of people, that's a lot of time for me not to be texting back. But I'm right. like, if it's really urgent, like I would answer, but if you're just, you know, it's just most of it not that urgent. So,
right. Well, I think you did answer my question about sustainability measures, because I think that idea of having access to you, that's something I've also really tried to change, because I noticed that keeps me in this hyper state all the time, because somebody else working on something and asking me a question then pulls me back into like work mm-hmm. mode, you know, and like, it's like setting those boundaries of saying mm-hmm. like, I'm sorry that this is when you're doing this, but I'm not going to get back to you on the part that you need from me until Monday or whatever. Right. So,
and most cases it's fine.
Like, it is. And actually it gives the other person permission to have a boundary too, is what I've found.
Yeah.
Like when I do that with the people I work with, they're like, oh my God. Yeah. Why am I doing this on a Friday night? Like, what the heck? Like, you know, so.
Exactly. Yes.
I also loved like the kind of reframe of, you know, cause I was like, I just need more another day in my week or whatever. I need more time. And you were like, I just need to take my time, right? Like we all have the same amount of time. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe like people like us who have this like very activated, you know, like motivation is not like an issue for me. It's like taking my foot off the gas actually, that mm-hmm. is like more the issue. Yeah. And I think, yeah, just like trusting that I have enough time for the work that I want to do, you know? Okay. Wow. I don't want to like start wrapping this up, but I do have one more big thing I want to talk about with you before we kind of move towards the end. Although I just feel like we need a day to
keep talking.
Yes. So we were kind of chatting before we pushed record, and actually in your bio that I read, you talk about being a nomadic artist. And I think this is so interesting, and I haven't really interviewed anybody where we've like really talked about this, but I know some artists who live in the Midwest, Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, who actually like purchase a studio, like a shared studio in Brooklyn, and they like somehow like go there like once in a while and like make use of that space in order to kind of like keep a foot in the door, like a physical presence in New York. And you were talking about how your art career kind of really built up in Atlanta, and you have all these connections, and you know, it's like a big source of like income and, you know, just kind of support for your art career. But then you moved to Florida. And so now you're having this experience of like, my art career physically takes place in, and not just like exhibition wise, but like I practice art and the building of my art career in two distinct geographic areas. And it's for like specific reasons.
Yeah.
How do you do that? What does that mean for your family? What does that mean for your finances? I just don't understand like how that works. I understand why you would want to do it as an artist, but like, give me some context.
Absolutely. Yeah. So this was like a thing that sort of happened organically. It was not so I grew up in Atlanta. I attended grad school in Atlanta. I built an art career and a community in Atlanta for myself. But then when I left grad school, my husband and I decided to move to Florida. And in particular, we moved to a small town called High Springs, which is like a 6,000 person rural town in North Central Florida. And when we were kind of making this decision, I was like, it's cool. I can make art anywhere. I can connect to people. It's like 2 hours away from Tallahassee and an hour from Jacksonville and 2 hours from Tampa and Orlando. It's like, there's lots of stuff around there, and I can still come to Atlanta if I need to, but I can have a home base anywhere. That was what I was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved here, and I very quickly learned that the reality is very different. Mm-hmm. For one, Florida is a very, I'm not sure if there are other states like this. I imagine a place like Texas would be like this and California would be like this because they're very big states, right? Mm-hmm. And Florida isn't necessarily as big as those states. But it is very interesting because in Florida, it is like three different states. There's North Central Florida, where there are almost no arts opportunities or support for the arts. Like it is very limited. Now, if you go into a city like Jacksonville or Tallahassee, there's things happening, but it's not at a scale that I would say is comparable to
significant.
Other
cities. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not significant. And then there's Central Florida, which is like this band across the state, where like Tampa and Orlando are kind Saint of in
Pete.
That. Yeah, St. Pete, yeah. They're all there. There's actually a lot happening there that's really impressive. And I love those communities. I think they're really fun. I had actually done a residency in Tampa when I was during grad school. And so I'm like, you know, I was like, okay, that's great. And then there's Miami, mm-hmm. South Florida. And essentially, like, I feel like in my experience since I've lived in Florida, it feels like everybody treats them like completely different states. Mm. And I would have no idea how to like connect to Miami other than like going to Basel and like applying to open calls, which I do. Mm-hmm. Like I'm trying to like connect with artists down there and things like that. Right. But it's very, it all feels very separate and very just difficult to connect to in ways mm-hmm. that I'm not anticipated.
Maybe insular.
Like, yeah. Very insular, you know? Yeah. And I mean, and that's true for a lot of communities all over the place. It happens.
Well, not to mention, yeah. I mean, I now live in the city of Fort Wayne, Indiana, which has like 300,000 to 400,000 people. Like if you, you know, like maybe larger, if you include like the suburby, it's the biggest place I've ever lived. And there's still not a lot going on with like art stuff here. When I lived in Tennessee, which is kind of where I really started my career, one thing I quickly realized was that if you want to be an artist in Tennessee, you have to live in Nashville or Memphis. Mm-hmm. And if not, even financial opportunities are not like accessible to you. Like all, like the majority of the grants, the majority of like the funding opportunities, the funded opportunities are like, you have to be a metro-based artist.
Yep. Yeah.
And like, that was so discouraging. So yeah. discouraging to
it's I yeah. mean, and I get it too. Like a part of me, like I understand it, right? You want to support your local community in whatever way. And like they want to see those funds kind of serving that local like area. Right. And so, but also it's like, it's bizarre to me because it's so difficult sometimes to then connect.
To even, and it's difficult yeah. for artists to even live in a metro area because right. the and affordability.
It's the affordability. Right. right. And then it's like, you know, and then what do rural artists do? Like if you live right. in a rural space, like how do you support your career unless you just happen to have lots of money, right. which is not my reality. So right. now it is more, it's like inexpensive kind of to live in a rural place compared to a city. Right. So that is right. the one thing that I had going for me. Right. Mm-hmm. The other thing I had going for me is, like I said, I had this community in Atlanta already and my day job is based out of Atlanta. So I was already okay. going back to Atlanta once a month I work for a pro bono law firm and I work part-time for them. Most of it's telecommuting, but I'm required to be there in person once a month for these events that I run logistics for. So I'm there already at this time when I was kind of considering this as an option. Right. I was already there for 3 days a month, sometimes a full week. And I was just taking Aria with me.
Okay.
And my collective that I'm a part of was primarily based in Atlanta. And this is partly where this idea comes from. But one of our collective members had a base in Atlanta, a base in New Orleans, and a base in Philadelphia. And she is the person who taught me how to be a nomadic person and how to connect communities, multiple communities, genuinely and fully. And she's just somebody I'm deeply impressed by and like, yeah. you know, but so she was already kind of doing this, right? And I was like, okay, so what would this look like? And so I started basically spending more time coming back to Atlanta for extended periods. My husband was very supportive because he kind of always has been. Mm-hmm. It's less a question of can I do this and like how do we make this happen than right. and that's usually he's like, okay, so how do we do this? Right. Is the question that we ask each other. And which is, I know I'm again, yet again, another privilege in my life is that I have this partner who's a real partner, yeah. you know, like we split the caregiving of our daughter pretty much. I mean, that has varied over time, you know, when
seasons,
but yeah, it has only gotten more equal. And maybe when she was younger, it was more me, but now mm-hmm. it's like very equal. And mm-hmm. that's, it's just, I know that's not the case for everybody. And he's pretty invested in making sure that my art career is like sustainable and supportive. I mean, if he had his way, I would stop running the organization here because he thinks it takes too much away from my studio. But I'm like, it feeds my studio in other ways. So,
yes.
So let's see, a couple of years ago, I have a studio in Florida and then I have a second studio in Atlanta.
Okay.
I have a home base there, like a home address there that I am at when I'm there and I have my job there. So it's like very easy in many ways. It's only 4.5 hours away from the High Springs. They're okay. like,
so you drive when you
I drive,
up.
Which a yep. lot of people are like, that seems like a lot. And I'm like, it's a really,
it's
easy
only 4 hours by the time you get to an hours. Airport.
Yeah. Like, yeah. 75, south or north, the straight shot. I listen to a lot of audiobooks. Yeah. You know, it's
4 hours is nothing. Those people must live in a city who say that. Like when you live in the country, it's like it takes you 20 minutes to just go to the grocery store,
Exactly. So it just doesn't feel like that much. And so I spend, you know, now I spend anywhere from a week to half a month in Atlanta every month. And I was talking to you this about it, you know, that also goes in seasons a little bit. Like the winter holidays, I'm often in Florida a little bit more than Atlanta. It's nice in Florida during the winter. During the summer, because the summer arts camp, I'm often in Florida a little bit more. But in the spring, for whatever reason, for the past like 3 years, all my projects have like my major projects have been in Atlanta in the spring. And so I have spent way more time in Atlanta than in Florida. And then additionally, there's this annual commission I get from another law firm that also happens in the spring. There's just, for whatever reason, it's been this like cycle where the springs are often like my Atlanta time and the fall is kind of a mix and the summer is Florida time. And then like, you know, holidays are what they are. So it's just like this organic building. I'd say the hardest thing about it, is that it's hard to make it super consistent.
I was thinking like it would be so hard to manage your time, like to decide when is the right time to be where and like how long, like what would be sustainable. Should I go up there for just 3 days or should I wait till I can get there for 10 days or like, piecing all that out.
It's never the same. Like it's always, you know, and it really depends on what projects are happening at my day job, which, you know, is its own thing. You know, I'm also trying to support other artists while I'm in Atlanta. So sometimes it depends on their schedules, like my collective, or I show a lot of Georgia-based artists at the space in Florida or in Alabama or whatever. So sometimes I'm having to transport work to and from their spaces. And so there's like all these schedules that I'm juggling that aren't always mine. Plus then it's like Aria was often with me. I would often take her because for whatever reason, it was just simpler for me to do so. Cause I have in many ways more flexibility and more capacity to multitask than my husband does.
Right.
That is less possible now because she's in school and she's in school down here. So
yeah, I was gonna say like I'll be interested to hear how this shifts for you as she gets older, because this is something I'm experiencing is that it's so funny because like, well, we homeschooled before we moved here. And so we had like maximum flexibility. Like we could hop in the car and do whatever we wanted. Yeah. My husband's a college professor. So like within the bounds of like that, you know, but it's like now that all three of my kids are in school full time, my 8 to 3 flexibility is like maximized, right? Like I'm like, I have all this, not all this time, like it goes very fast, but you know, I have time during the week. But what I find is that my ability to be flexible in terms of travel has like gone way down because, you know, your kids being in like a school community, it like makes you more rooted to the physical community that you're a part of, like as your family kind of becomes more integrated, like into that, to that community. And I don't know, it's hard to schedule things. Like if you don't know when like a concert's going to pop up or like your kid wants to get involved in this. And like,
And we haven't really struggled with it yet because again,
She's 5.
And my partner is like very much like, you still take the trips to Atlanta and now you just get to go alone, which is a whole nother gift that I can't even like, I love my family, but I also am a highly independent person. So finding time to be by myself for extended periods of time is like a huge gift. So the fact that the past few months that I like this whole fall and actually a part of the summer too, when I was in Atlanta, I was often by myself, which is just like for like 7 to 10 days, sometimes a whole half month or whatever, is like, it just feels like wildly like, again, privileged. I can't think of a better word for it, you know?
Yeah.
And
nourishing. How about nourishing?
Yeah, nourishing. I can focus in ways on my work that I just, you know, I'm very good at multitasking, but I know that there's a difference when I'm able to like, hey, I have this much time to get my day job stuff done. Good. Now I have this much time to be in my studio and nobody else is demanding my time or asking for my time. Not that they demand it. Right. Mm-hmm. But like, as good as I am at multitasking, as equal as the partnerships are in my family and like as much community as I have here with my mother and my mother-in-law all helping, I am also a person who I know, like, if I can give my time to somebody, I will. Mm-hmm. And so it's sometimes hard for me to like stop the request for my time if I'm physically present. Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, why would I say no? Mm-hmm. Unless like I'm in a work meeting that I can't get out of. Right.
Yes.
So when I go to Atlanta, if I'm on my own, when I'm there, it's like I'm a solitary person with no demands on my time other than the ones that I make myself, which is just a very different position than I am in all the time, especially as a parent and caregiver. So,
Well, really interesting. I think your specific way that you have set it up obviously is like unique to you, but I do think there's like more and more artists who are kind of plugging into models like this. And I don't know, it's like something to really think about. Cause
aside from my friend who I talked about, I know I was rereading Bell Hooks All About Love. Mm-hmm. She actually talks about this.
Oh, like, really?
It's really brief. I don't recall that it's a very long conversation. And it's not like she like elucidates lots of details about it, but she mentions that she has this rural home in addition to her home in the city. And I was like, oh yes. And I think probably one more artists do this than they talk about it, because I think much like the fear of becoming an artist parent and what people will say, there is a little bit of fear about like, if you don't live in a city in a center, if you don't live there all the time, can you really truly be a part of that community?
Right.
I don't think there's anything wrong with finding different ways to build different communities. Cause I learn a lot from the people I love in Atlanta and the people that I surround myself with there. And I learn a lot from the people here in High Springs that are, I don't always see eye to eye with, but like, there's still a lot that I learned from this community. And so I think having both has become really vital to how I function in the world, both as like a parent and an artist, also like a community member, because I serve really different roles in each community. So,
well, and I think it, you know, it definitely, it makes you like an artist who kind of is engaged in multiple, you know, I don't like the terms like high and low, but like these experiences of like community-based arts in a rural, like Florida, like conservative community. Mm-hmm. Like you are like building something there, but then you are also a capital A artist who has a presence in like one of the top five art cities in the US, you know? And so like that's like quite a range of like, sort of diverse like experiences and communities. And I don't think like any one artist carries that with them all the time. You know, like you might go through seasons of like, I grew up in here, but then now I'm here and like, I'm not going to talk about that part of my life anymore. Like, it's like, I just love that idea of kind of embracing all of it and both pouring yourself into all of it, but then also like, you know, being nourished by all of it too. So
thank you.
Okay, Jessica, we got to wrap up. We're going over time here. So final five questions, just a way for our listeners to get to know you a little bit better. Mm-hmm. Biggest art crush.
Ebony G. Patterson. Definitely.
Awesome. Who, what is your favorite place to travel or a dream trip you'd like to go on?
So I actually get to have mine in January because I have a solo show in Korea in January that I am traveling to Korea and I'm having my dream trip for a week there.
Amazing. That's so awesome. Is your family going with you or are you enjoying time alone?
Just my husband, actually. And he's he's going for, like, he's working, like, I'm putting him to work. He's gonna
help. Oh my gosh.
And he's gonna photograph and document. So
that's like my dream trip, because A, I love when my husband like helps me with art stuff and he likes it too. Mm-hmm. And B, we love to travel. So that sounds amazing.
I'm trying to like get him to have a travel bug, because I love travel. I like I want it to be a part of my life, but it you know, it's expensive. So we're getting there.
Okay, tell me a film or a book that has been a big inspiration to you. Or just something you're currently really enjoying.
So I'm currently reading, this is a hard one because the reading's a big part of my life, as are films. But right now I'm reading a little memoir by Maya Angelou, which I've never read before. I actually haven't read a lot of her writing, which I was like, this is a weird gap for me to have. So I like a bunch of her books. And I just talked about this story with some friends, but the first story in this like little collection of short stories about her life is about this house that she lived in with one of her husbands that didn't like her. And I love the way she talks about the space as, you know, as a personality and a force that basically separated her and her husband. And if they had been in a different house that liked her better, they would still be together. But then she, that's the first
part. Cool.
And then the second part of the story is about how she moves after they separate, after they divorce. And she's like trying to figure out where she's going to live. And she was going to live in this like smaller house, because she's like, I don't need this big space. I don't need a big, but it didn't feel right. And it didn't fit right with all the things she had. And she's like, well, why do I feel like I need to make myself smaller just because I don't have this partner or this specific kind of life? So instead she reacts to this internal feeling rather than whatever practical or outside external thing that she's trying she's like ignoring that, and she's listening to this internal feeling, and she like gets this big house that she's lived in for a long time, and eventually she adds 10 rooms and people come and go, and it becomes a space of community for her.
Wow.
And I just love the way she talks about living spaces and building them and building community and reacting in an internal sort of instinctual way rather than this external sort of expected way.
What was the name of it, do you know?
I don't have it next to me, and I can't.
Okay, we'll link it. You can email it to me, and we'll link it. It'll be on the show.
I wish I had it right here, because then I could read it. But yeah,
it sounds really good. What is your favorite meal?
Also hard. I love food so much. My husband was a chef, so like he cooks. Okay. I don't cook in my house. He cooks, and really great, and he's really good at it. His thing for me is like if I'm. Or like, I love a steak, and I love a steak with like vegetables, like green vegetables. And that's like the best thing in the world to me, especially the way he makes it. And especially because he usually reserves it when I seem really lethargic or down. He's like, you need red meat. Here you go. So I just can't escape it. So
I would think that's like a good PMS meal. Like I'm ready for some.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And who would you like to give a shout out to who supports you in your work?
Obviously my family, my partner, my daughter, my mother, my mother-in-law, like all my family, but also my collective, my friends, Danielle, Haley, Angela, and Angela are like vital to my practice. But then there are other friends who would not consider themselves artists, but who are vital to like my everyday. So someone like Lauren, my sister who lives in another country, like there's just a lot of people who make my life possible. Like I'm 100% believer that none of this happens alone.
Mm-hmm.
And
takes a village to raise a kid. It also takes a village to be an artist.
It really does. It really, really does. And I hope that every one of those people, even the ones I didn't name, know how important they are to what I do.
So. Okay, Jessica, where can listeners connect with you or find out more about your work? What's like your website, Instagram?
Yes. So my website is just www.jessicacaldas.com. And I keep it mostly up to date. I post a lot on Instagram, and my Instagram handle is Zinka Project, Z-I-N-K-A Project. But it's not like art specific. It's personal stuff too. So if you go on there, just know that about me. And those are like the two best places to learn about what I'm doing. So.
Awesome. Well, I'm inspired. Thank you so much for just a great conversation, and Yeah, for validating my multi-passionate personality. Yes. We've got a lot going on.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. And you need it. It is. Just remember to rest when you need it.
That's absolutely. It. You too.
Thank you so much, Kaylin.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.